that one.
So paleopharmacology is a real honest-to-God word. I haven't found it in Wikipedia yet, but I should...
Oh, Carl Doolittle.
I should probably just put it in.
Yeah.
And the theoretical foundation for this field was Arteza's study of Aztec medicine, the codex that the Spanish had made of Aztec plants. And what Ortiz did is went through and identified what plants you're talking about. In this case, it's a cacao plant, the coca plant. And there were annotations of what the plant was used for. In the case of Anthelminthix, they would draw the plant with a little pot of expelled worms for the Aztec interpretation of what the plant was good for. And what I thought is what we could do is take this method and apply it in prehistory using, of course, the wonderful alternative databases provided by coprolites. That's a coprolite. So coprolite analysis has obvious implications to the field and can extend our knowledge of medicinal plants far back in time. For example, Fry was the first guy to find evidence of medicinal cornice bark and coprolite set from the Great Basin in Utah. And then I started talking about seeds in 1985, and Riley reviewed that work, and a lot of people picked up on looking at seeds in coprolites, primarily looking at Chenopodium. There are many different varieties of Chenopodium that produce different kinds of seeds. This seed up here, a little amorphous and simple seed, comes from Chenopodium species that are used for anthelminthix. So this...
Carl, can you elaborate a little bit on Chenopodium?
Chenopodium is in the family Chenopodiaceae. I think they're 1,300 species. It's in that number is in a paper I published this year. I think that's right. A number of those species are useful for humans. Most of those useful species are dietary. And as a matter of fact, the use of Chenopodium as a dietary plant is in North America, prehistorically, is in North America, South America, Europe, and over into Asia. So people all over the world focused on these plants as a dietary source.
Related thing, we put it into something. Is it pigweed?
It's pigweed.
See? But I mean, what is pigweed, really?
It's Chenopodium.
Okay. Well, pigweed, okay, the Chenopodiaceae and the Amaranthaceae are two different plants that we view as Chenopodium or goosefoot. It's goosefoot. Amaranthus, which is pigweed. So these two plants are very close together. I used to go down to the farmer's market and buy the greens from this to cook up. They're very good greens, very good seeds for dietary uses. A smaller component of only Chenopodium, Amaranthus is also a good dietary plant, produces an oil called oil of Chenopodium, oddly enough, that kills roundworms. And they typically have smaller, unornamented seeds like that. And Chenopodium ambrosioides is one species, a wild species of that. We also cultivated in the 1700s and 1800s Chenopodium anthelminthicum. Its specific epithet came from the fact that it was used to kill helminths as a vermifuge. So, but then around the late 80s and published in the early 90s, I said, wouldn't it be neat if we could start looking at coprolites to recover pollen evidence in medicinal plants? And in the late 80s, published in the early 90s, I found that willow, creosote, and ephedra, which is Mormon tea, could be recovered from coprolites, providing you use a special method to make sure that you weren't confusing windborne pollen with actual use of plants. Because when you're interpreting pollen from prehistoric sites or forensic settings, if you want to take my class, you guys, your graduate students, you can take this class too. You can take my incredible class, which will be taught next fall in palynology, which will explain to you everything you know about pollen. Usually we require botany, plant taxonomy, plant ecology, plant anatomy, advanced theoretical physics, and several courses in philosophy as prerequisites, or zoology as prerequisites. But because you guys are here today, we'll waive that for you.
Isn't ephedra used currently in the weight loss?
Yes. People concentrate ephedrine out of this, which has gotten into the press lately. Prehistoric people used this for other reasons. It was a diuretic. As a matter of fact, the Hopis used ephedra viridis to treat the symptoms of syphilis when syphilis is introduced to them. It also is a vasodilantant, and it also helps with respiration. So it's got a variety of other aspects to it other than the basic stimulant, I think, that has gotten people in trouble with it lately. Didn't a baseball player collapse from too much ephedrine use? Okay, of course, Salix is an analgesic. Aspirin comes from Salix. Laria is great for diarrhea, and there's a whole amusing story about a certain site where people suffered from diarrhea because of the water they ate, and that's where we found lots of evidence of creosote treatment. Now, what I argued in the early 90s is what we had to do is pollen concentration to determine how many pollen grains are present per gram of coprolite. Because if you just analyze your pollen without quantifying how much pollen is there, you're essentially interpreting percentages of pollen, which is not a good way to go if you're trying to find out whether a plant that is wind pollinated was used prehistorically as a medicine. Because we ingest, well, what I find in coprolites is 10 to 20,000 pollen grains per gram of just ingested wind pollinated pollen in food, inhalation, so from those kinds of sources. But if we find 50,000, 100,000, or a million pollen grains of a wind-pollinated type per gram of coprolite, then we're starting to look at intentional use on the part of prehistoric folks and selecting the plants for dietary use or medicinal use or use as spice. So I use this formula. And what is a marker grain? And that marker grains are essential because we add marker grains, exotic marker pollen grains, to quantify what we're doing. So we typically add, I typically add 12,500 exotic grains per gram of coprolite for quantification. And what I typically use are Lycopodium spores, which Lycopodium is from...
Lycopodium.
This is from club moss. Club moss. And we're not looking at pollen from these, we're looking at spores. So it's a different thing, but the spores are durable like pollen grains. And so what I do is count my pollen, count my added spores, and then calculate how many ancient pollen grains I have per sediment. I also do this with parasite eggs, so I can assess how many eggs per gram or there are in coprolites or eggs per milliliters in latrine soils.
So Carl, who sells this stuff and can't perform? Is this a health food?
No. These are actually made by a special paleontological outfit in Sweden. And these spore tablets are made every 6 to 10 years. So when they're made, you buy a whole supply to last you as long as you can possibly imagine. And so I keep about 20 bottles at 500 tablets per bottle is reserved for if Sweden is ever inundated due to global warming or something. So that's what I use for tracing. Now, why is this good? Well, if you look at this diagram up here, the total number of pollen grains in this was 3,300,000 grains of pollen per gram of coprolite. Contrast, this is just 20,000 pollen grains per gram of coprolite. Sorry about that. That looked a lot better on my computer last night. Now, and all of these types here are your normal pollen rain. What you find in the Southwest that people inhale or ingest in one way or the other. Whereas here, the majority of the pollen comes from ephedra. So in the upper pick of coprolite, we have 2,805,000 ephedra pollen grains per gram of coprolite. When you see that number speaks to you about human use of that plant. Then you go to the ethnobotanical literature, which ethnobotany is a field of that looks at how people in different cultures use plants for various uses. So you look at paleoethnobotanical literature to see what species in that area were used for what purposes. And ephedra is a little bit more complicated botanically because it is both insect pollinated and wind pollinated. So you have to consider that too from the plant ecology perspective. But 2 million is a strong indicator that they're using ephedra for something. And that's that area, the species of ephedra, were used as a medicine. Okay.
Is it quercus there?
Quercus. Oh, yeah. So, for example, oak, wild grass, pine, this would be ragweed, creosote, juniper, and Chenopodium and Amaranthus types, which we call Chenoam because the pollen is indistinguishable, are what dominated the natural pollen rain in that area. Yes, indeed.
So it's going to vary by season, right? I mean, if you're collecting these things, you don't necessarily know when, well, maybe you can determine when.
Actually, that's something I just published this year in looking at seasonality of site use by feces. And what you can do is look at the season, the pollination season, and then compare. So if you have, in this case, there were 17, this is 10 other taxa, 17 pollen types. So what you can do is look at the pollination ecology and season of month of pollination for each of those types, and then get an estimate of whether you're looking at a spring, summer, fall pollination strategy. That's handy too when you're looking at skeletons. So I analyzed the sediments and the coprolites from skeletons, and you can get an idea of when a person died based on the background pollen.
Wow.
Because the pollen spectrum will vary with season.
Season.
Yeah. And so that's the main reason, main thing.
I thought
they, you know,
what
time is that? Oh, no. In the morning. I can't do that. Except through metaphysical processes, which I didn't want to talk about today. Because I'm going to introduce this incredible joke word at this point in time. Okay, but many paleoethnobotanists, and this is a shock to me, because I described this technique in 1991, and it's in all the literature, but many paleoethnobotanists do not use pollen concentration as an analytical method. Paleoethnobotany is the field that focuses on reconstructing prehistoric plant use by people, okay? Okay, paleoethnobotany. How are we ever going to figure out what pollen types resulted from the use of medicinal plants? Can a regular guy like myself help out using the paleoethno-eco-botanical approach? And I figured this image right here, which shows me at Carnival in Rio de Janeiro, really characterizes in a single image the paleoethno-eco-botanical approach, because it's paleo because it's with me, ethno because it was made for an ethnic celebration, eco because this particular float focused on the destruction of the Amazon rainforest, and botanical because it is so botanical. There you go. My logic for my image captures. And it all started one sunny day in Rio de Janeiro. That's me in Rio de Janeiro. I'm always thinner there. With my friend Sergio Miranda Chavez as we prepared for a conference, palynology conference in London. So it's a complicated international thing. But essentially, we went to give... Now, I downloaded all of these titles that you're going to see from the conference website. And it appalled me how these folks butchered our titles. So there was a symposium just on coprolites, which was called the Feces-Faces Session. Feces being a funny English spelling of feces. Faces is a geological term. A session is something we all use. But what Sergio's title came out to be is a contribution to the palynology of coprolites, the study on diseases and the pharmacopoeia of prehistoric men of the Paleo-Indian people from Piauí, northeastern Brazil. Somebody should have just stopped it right there and let that title go. But I presented this paper because Sergio didn't get money from Brazil to go at the last minute. So I presented this paper, and his problem was he was working with five coprolites. He found 12 different pollen types of medicinal plants out of a total of 30 different types of pollen. And the skepticism among the audience was, how do you know that the types are medicinal when you only have pollen percentages, which he did? On the other hand, everybody was astounded at the number of medicinal pollen types, and the question then was, well, is it not just the sheer number of medicinal pollen types that reinforces the evidence that this is actual medicinal usage? So then Sergio submitted his paper. Oh, I just want to see other incredible titles from this symposium. This is a great symposium if you like feces. Analyzing the intestinal contents of ancient icemen, Otzi and a long ago person found. This again was a real title. Revealing itineraries and domiciles. The actual paper is really interesting because they used the feces from the iceman to figure out where he'd been, because pollen will rattle around the intestinal tract of a human for 21 days before it's expelled, and what kind of environment he lived in before going to the Alps. And then early in late Christian diet in Nubia, the science of coprolite analysis.
Hang on, Carl, what's the date of early and late Christian?
Ooh, this is a sad thing you asked, John, because I read this paper too, because the author couldn't come.
The reason I ask, you know, I may be way off base here in a lot of ways, but there's this dietary cooking fava bean interaction that deals with enabling sickle trait to survive. There's some combination relative to malaria and fava bean and the sickle trait. We always talk about sickle trait and malaria, but not necessarily fava bean.
Fava bean cultivation started in Ethiopia, I believe, and then spread to Egypt and in Levant, and then I think favism itself is something we see in Greece, isn't it?
Well, in modern times, but say that the if I remember all this dietary stuff correctly, that the food, the preparation of fava beans, once they were introduced into Africa, and probably from the East, the preparation techniques then allowed the use of those beans to culturally, even in areas where favism would have been a dietary consequence.
Hmm.
So maybe I'm wrong about all this.
Well, I can't remember any of the details.
Glucose 6 phosphate dehydrogenase and thalassemia, and there's a bunch of those blood conditions, genetic blood conditions that produce hemolytic anemias with alkaloids, plant alkaloids. So there's some connection there.
She didn't publish this paper, and I don't even think I kept the copy I read for her. Her data, though, is published in a 1992 book, which I can send you the reference to that, because that stuff is published, if you want to take a look at it. It's a book entitled Paleonutrition, and I could get to... One of the amusing aspects of coprology is Heinz Cave. This is a cave named Heinz Cave before they discovered thousands of coprolites in it dating to archaic times. And I've always thought it was funny that we would have a view from Heinz Cave relating to coprolites. And the other thing that struck me is, did sheep and goat eat pollen in Neolithic rainforest? An interesting paper about the change in the palynology from various times in prehistory, which indicated that the forest was eaten up after people cultivated sheep and goats. But I also thought it was funny that we should talk about coprolites from pile dwellings. I have this image of dwellings composed of coprolites. Fossil pollen grains are the digestive of mice and mastodons, which made me wonder if mastodons were afraid of mice just as elephants are afraid of mice today, which we all know is a fact. And I think some of the most interesting papers were these ancient rocks with little tiny structures in them that look like rice grains, but they turned out to be insect insect coprolites full of ancient spores. Fascinating. It was just great. The weird thing about the conference was we had break titles like Elevenses. I thought there was going to be hobbits there, you know, like second breakfasts. And tea time, there was no coffee at tea time, which was a shock to me. But Sergio's data source came from five coprolites from the site of Boqueirão de Pedra Furada in Brazil. And they came from three strata that were dated at 8,450 years ago, 7,750 years ago, and 7,230 years ago. And those are three of his coprolites there. And what, and here is the site. So it's Boqueirão de Pedra Furada. And this area, including the state of Ceará, part of the state of Piauí, Rio Grande do Norte, Paraíba, Pernambuco, Alagoas, and Sergipe, in the northern part of Bahia, is the Sertão, this big desertic area in northeastern Brazil. Kind of neat place. Well, culinarily, if you're a parasitologist, you work with the poorest people, and you eat a lot of manioc flour mixed with dried goat. And I have to tell you, after a week, this just stuck in my throat, like my seal meat days in Alaska. It was just, okay, don't go there. Go here, Salvador de Bahia, a great place to go, great food there, and you can get into the African Candomblé religion. So that's where I recommend going. This is, now Sergio did something fairly amazing. He counted a hell of a lot of pollen grains. In North American archaeobotany, we count 200 pollen grains per sample, and we thought, why do we do that? Because you can spend your life counting pollen grains. And statistically, we decided that 200 grains is when we stop. If you go to 1,000, you reach the 97% confidence interval with regard to how well your pollen count reflects the original pollen spectrum in your sample. Okay, that's good. But to get to 1,000 often takes days and days or weeks and weeks at a microscope. So we found that this, a statistician analyzed pollen data compared to ecological data, and he determined that if you count 200 grains, you can get to about an 85% confidence interval. And we as palynologists decided that's good enough. For the amount of time we spend, that's good enough. But Sergio counted over 1,000 pollen grains for every one of his coprolites. I do that occasionally, but only when I'm driven. But it really allowed him to get not only at the common pollen types, but also trace pollen types that might be important from a paleoethnobotanical perspective. Okay, and that's a sweet potato, Ipomoea pollen grain there. All right. Among the 30 pollen types he found 12 potential medicinal taxon. He asked me, once his paper got rejected, to help him figure out what are actually medicinal and what aren't. And so right here we're presenting the scientific, the genus. We can't get to species. We can only get to genus based on pollen morphology. And with Quinoanthap, we can only get to either the Echinopodiaceae or Amaranthaceae, so only to the family level. Alternifera doesn't have a common name that I could find. Anacardium in Portuguese is caju, cashew in English. Anadendothera, which really needs a common name because I can't pronounce it, is angico in Portuguese. I don't know what we call it in English. Bauinia is mororo de sertão, which in English is mororo of the sertão, and I don't know. Is there mororo? Is that a Spanish word as well?
No. Is that like more or something?
Like, no. I don't know. It's a word that I've not found. Borreria, cabeça de velho, old man's head. I love that. Calcalpinia is palfero or ironwood. Cecropia is umbauba or umbauba, which is in the mulberry family. Quinoam is either Quinopodiaceae or the genus Amaranthus. They put all the plants, and there's 1,300 several hundred species of Chenopodium and Chenopodiaceae and Amaranthus that produce the very same pollen. It has two common names in Portuguese, mentruz and mastruço, which translate mastruço to worm plant. Croton is marmoleiro, and that is a PUE-specific word referring to a medicinal plant. Manzora is cepo de alho, or garlic weed. Is cepo also a Spanish word?
Cepo.
Cepo?
Yeah.
Okay. And saida is malva benta, or salbento salve, or salve. And terminalia is maçarico, which refers to aquatic birds. It's a, the plant name refers to aquatic birds, and I don't know anything more than that. So we're working with these medicinal taxa. And the question that I said that we have to ask is there a paleopathological evidence requiring treatment? In other words, look at the skeletons, look at the coprolites for evidence of disease that might have needed treatment. Then we have to ask, is there a therapeutic match between the medicinal needs in prehistory and what you found in medicinal plants? For example, if people are suffering from digestive complaints, a medicinal plant that you found is good for growing hair, then more likely or not, this medicine wasn't needed by those folks. Therefore, it's a weak case to make for a medicinal plant. I don't know. That just came out of my head to provide an example to everybody here that... Oh, okay. Well, I don't know. And the problem if you're working with Native American paleoethnobotany is Native Americans do not lose their hair. So we're probably working in the wrong part of the world. We've got to go to Northern Europe. Probably, oh, let's go on. Now you've got me thinking about that. Is it likely that the pollen be carried by the part of the plant that is used ethnographically for medicine? Then you have to go to the ethnobotanical literature and find out what parts of the plant are useful, or the ethnopharmacology. So for example, if people are using the roots of the plant, it's not likely that you're going to get pollen from a root. Is it likely that the pollen will persist in the application of the medicine? Actually, that would be the preparation application. For example, if you take foliage, and then you wash the foliage, and then you boil the foliage, you're going to lose a lot of pollen in the process of doing that. And if you're not taking the medicine internally, you're not going to get the pollen concentrated in the intestinal system. Is the plant pollen represented in Norman pollen rain? That's a very important thing, and as we talked about with regard to what is pollen rain and separating out the use, what is the actual use of wind pollinated types versus something that could just be ingested. Can pollen be used to make a refined identification of medicinal genera or species that you're looking at? Finally, is the amount of pollen present in the coprolites consistent with medicinal usage? If you found 2 pollen grains out of 1,000, probably not too significant. So I came up with this groovy, I think it's called a fault tree analysis, where if you find a reported pollen taxa, you first have to ask, is it endemic to the area? If it's endemic, then you have to ask, is there a therapeutic property to match a purported use? And if that's the case, then you have to say, is a pollen present in medicinal preparation? Is it an oral medication? Is it insect pollinated? If it's not insect pollinated, if it's wind pollinated, then you have to think about things very critically. Do you have a distinct morphology? Is a pollen abundant in the coprolite? If you can answer all of those different criteria, then you have a good potential that a taxon is medicinal or poison. That's the complexity of working in an area with which you're not familiar. Now, with regard to paleopathology evidence, we find whipworm and hookworm at the same period, 7,000 to 8,000 years ago. So, and not just a small number of coprolites. Many of the coprolites, if I remember, about 40% of the coprolites of about 150 that have been studied had whipworm or hookworm or both. We found lice on isolated hair shafts dating to 11,000 years ago. The bones of these ancient folks show fractures, osteoarthritis, and dental abscesses. So we would anticipate that they would need treatments for some symptoms, including dental pain, joint complaints, pain associated with fractures, intestinal disorders, skin lesions, intestinal disorders, and physiological response, these coming from whipworm and then hookworm, and then itching and rash coming from your lice. So then, is everybody with me so far? Because some people are, Gabe, you're looking a little dazed, a little glassy-eyed. Are you all right?
I usually look like that.
Oh, okay. Yeah, everybody's okay. Now, so what are the ethnobotanical observations? We want to know, are the symptoms of these plants treated something that was present in history and in prehistory? And are the parts of the plant that are used likely to carry pollen? Alternathera, they use the leaves. So when you see leaves being used, there's potential for pollen to be present, but not a great potential. It's used for inflammation, cough, and dysentery. Anacardium, the leaves and the barks are used. This is wind pollinated. So wind pollinated plants, the pollen gets all over the leaves and barks. And it's used for dysentery and bleeding. So, and that's intestinal bleeding. So that this is a good candidate for a medicinal plant used in prehistory. Anandenathera, for which we need a good common name. The leaves and bark are used. It's insect pollinated. So can't be really confident that they're going to get a lot of pollen in a medicinal preparation. It's good for respiratory infections and dental pain. Bauhinia, the resin is used, and it's an expectorant. Resin tends to catch pollen, and I've analyzed resin from archaeological sites, and it's a very good pollen trap. Boeria and Cesalpinia, the foliage is used. Foliage includes buds. When buds are used, you get pollen. So by the time a bud is formed, you can visibly see the bud, the pollen is present. Okay, and that's good for intestinal problems and dysentery. Cecropia, leaves are used for pain. Quinoam types, leaves are used for helminth infection. Croton, leaves are used for rheumatism, headache, and respiratory problems. Manzoa is used for leaves, or the leaves are used for diabetes and sore throat. Diabetes is a modern disease. There's no evidence of it in Indians even before the 1930s. And so this remedy doesn't match the prehistoric needs. But people probably had sore throats for various reasons. Cida, a poultice is made from the plants for wounds. And terminalia, the foliage is used for dysentery. So looking at the ethnobotanical observations of the 12 potential medicinal plants, and the five coprolites, that's five, all were needed by the prehistoric people from the region. For the most part, the therapeutic properties of the plants match the paleopathological and medicinal needs. So we can't eliminate any plant from consideration based on its the treatment, the, what it's used to treat with regard to symptomology. Is it likely that pollen will be carried by the part of the plant that's used ethnographically for medicine? Infusions of foliage were made from Alternathera, Anacardium, Boreria, Cida, Terminalia, Cesalpinia, Cecropia, Croton, Manzoa, and Chenopodium type. And infusions of the flowers were made from Cesalpinia. Therefore, it's possible that pollen would have been incorporated in medicines from these plants. So we can keep these in consideration based on the potential that pollen would come with a medicinal treatment. Is it likely that the pollen would persist in the application of the medicine? Cida is not taken internally. It's an external application. So we have to eliminate this guy from consideration. Is a pollination strategy of the plant in question prone to be represented in normal pollen rain? Anacardium and quinoam are wind-pollinated types. So we have to think about these very carefully and look at the data for overwhelming evidence that they're used before we can accept them. Do all species in the genus have medicinal value? If this is true, then the identification to the genus level is sufficient to make a medicinal interpretation. Are there many genera and species in a family with similar pollen? Those are two different questions we have to ask. And the first one we're going to answer is, among the genera presented here, the quinoam type shares a morphology with non-medical taxa, medicinal taxa, and the Chenopodiaceae and Amaranthaceae. Therefore, it's not wise to infer medicinal use of the quinopodium type without more intensive critical analysis. Got it? Oh, even Scott's yawning. Okay. I want everybody, for just 10 seconds, to look inside yourselves for an exciting thought. Just an exciting thought. 5 more seconds. Exciting thought. Very good. Okay, we're going on. Now, the good news for many of these plants, we can only get to the genus identification, but for the serpent, we have a really poor abundance of plants. So there's one species in the genus Alternifera. So we're looking here, this is the number of species in the genus that are medicinal. One out of one are medicinal for Alternifera. Hey, that's a good consideration for medicinal plant. Anacardium, one of one. That's also a good consideration. Borrelia, one out of one. Cecropia, one out of one. Amenzoa, one out of one, except this reference is really ambivalent, so I'm not really happy with that. On the other hand, we have for the Kinoem type, one species out of hundreds of species is medicinal. So it's very unlikely that we're looking at medicinal plants. With Croton, there's one species out of 27 Crotons in that area that are medicinal. So again, with those plants, we're seeing a different end of the spectrum where it's very unlikely that people will be using those plants. So then, is the amount of pollen present in the coprolites consistent with medicinal use? With the entomophilus, entomophilus means insect pollinated. Assessing simple percentages is often effective for identifying intentional use of the plant taxon. Why is that? Insect pollinated plants produce hundreds of pollen grains per flower generally. Wind pollinated plants produce thousands to 10,000s of pollen grains per flower. Therefore, you typically find in your standard pollen rain, 2% or less of the standard pollen rain is made up of Entomophilus taxa. Therefore, as a rule of thumb, we say if you find 4% or more of a taxon making
You're going to have to edit this. Is it still running?
Yeah.
Okay. Let me back that up. If you find 4% or more of the pollen spectrum coming from an Entomophilus species, you have a certain degree of confidence that that is economic use of a plant represented there. Okay? So we essentially use plant ecology data to establish our criteria for identifying the use of insect pollinated plants. So we have Borrelia, Croton, Cydon, and Terminalia, in which you have pollen percentages getting up there. Reinhard, that's me, stressed the importance of using pollen concentration for interpreting intentional use of Anemophilus wind pollinated types. Kinopodium type and Alternifera are wind pollinated, and without pollen concentration analysis, interpreting intentional use is difficult. We have 18.4% of Kinopodium might or might not be the ingestion of ambient pollen. We think it's more likely that the 35.3% value for Alternifera could be due to the intentional use of this plant. So what can we derive? Okay, so these are the pollen percentages that Sergio came up with. With some of his insect pollinated plants, like Borrelia, he's more or less consistently finding super high percentages of pollen. So 26%, 23%, 22%, and almost 27% of the pollen spectrum coming from this insect pollinated species is certainly representative of intentional use of that plant. And because there's one species in that area and it's medicinal, then this is super good evidence of medicinal plant. Cider would be good, except that, of course, it's applied as a poultice, so it's really bad case. So in summary, if we look at these, we find that only with Anacardium, Borrelia, Terminalia, and there's one more, only with those three species, can we answer all the questions with regard to the pollen data and make strong cases for the use of these plants in prehistory as medicines. It's interesting, though, that of the two, okay, so the conclusion is we must conclude that of the 12 potential medicinal generally found, only Anacardium, Borrelia, and Terminalia remain as strong candidates for the actual prehistoric medicinal use. It's noteworthy that all three of these candidates are used to treat the maladies of the digestive tract, and two are dysentery treatments. This correlates well to the archaeoparasitological evidence. Another word that I invented, archaeoparasitology, which is now in two dictionaries of archaeology. This correlates well to the archaeoparasitological evidence of hookworm and whipworm parasitism in the same population. So, you know, that's what I had to say today. Oh, and that's a citation. It's out now. You can read it on the web.
What's the journal?
Paleogeography, paleoclimatology, and paleoecology.
One journal?
We call it PaleoCubed. The origin of this journal was many years ago, and they had separate journals for all of this. And with the declining submissions to these, they then decided to put it into one journal. And it's also one of our former vice president, what's his name, Rick Edwards, Indicators of Excellence journal. So, yeah, so an SNR, I still have to behave or modify or address that issue. So I published two articles in that journal this year.
Carl, I have one quick question.
I'm here to answer your questions.
Business of diarrhea. I don't know that there's any information. Maybe you can help me about things like Giardia. I mean, there is so much. There's so many different causes of diarrhea that it's difficult. You know what I mean? To generalize, but or to even think about specific causes. But ecologically, I don't know what would be a zoonotic reservoir for Giardia in the neotropics, if there is one. And I don't even know if Giardia is present, would have been present. But as soon as, you know, particularly even over a over a sort of a prescribed geographical area where in North America or Colorado, you'd say that stream is full of infected beavers, don't drink out of it. The other stream, I didn't get sick, or, you know, backpacker lore. But
beaver fever.
So you wonder about that kind of stuff in other parts of the world.
Well, we can answer that question with real data, because in 2002 we did a paper looking for, we did a lyse analysis of coprolites for Giardia, and then 2004, second paper. These are both in the Royal Academy of Tropical Medicine Hygiene.
You actually did look for Giardia?
Giardia and Entamoeba stolytica, and those were found. The other thing that a molecular biologist amplified and recovered, cholera. Bacterium, and that's not published. But so these folks had a protozoa that could cause diarrhea, and then a bacterium that caused diarrhea.
Is that visual or molecular?
It was molecular for the cholera, and she was really excited about it. I remember the day she came? She got this strange sequence that she amplified and prepared a gene bank, and it was consistent with the cholera. And the ELISA is done positive, negative, and then with a color detector to determine the strength of the reaction. So, yeah, these folks were susceptible to diarrhea, but there's also something, too, which we call green corn diarrhea in the Southwest. They didn't have corn, but there was a dietary cause for diet for folks eating food in the early spring when food was just coming into production after the lean times of the winter, in which they would ingest essentially the parts of the, well, unripe or pre-ripe fruits that would cause diarrhea. This area, I'm a little confused about the paleoecology.